August 17th, 2013, Hilo, Hawaii, class over Skype. We're going to be looking at Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 12. This is a three-part class. Today we're looking at texts 1 through 7. So I'm just going to go through and read the translations of 1 through 7. Arjuna inquired, "Which are considered to be more perfect, those who are always properly engaged in your devotional service, or those who worship the impersonal Brahman, the unmanifested?" The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Those who fix their minds on my personal form and are always engaged in worshiping me with great and transcendental faith are considered by me to be most perfect. But those who fully worship the unmanifested, that which lies beyond the perception of the senses, the all-pervading, inconceivable, unchanging, fixed and immovable, the impersonal conception of the Absolute Truth, by controlling the various senses and being equally disposed to everyone, such persons engaged in the welfare of all at last achieve me. For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied. But those who worship me, giving up all their activities unto me and being devoted to me without deviation, engage in devotional service and always meditating upon me, having fixed their minds upon me, O son of Pritha, for them I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death." So here's an overview of the three parts of the seminar. Part one, which we're going to be doing today, is an overview of the two paths to perfection. For each path, we're going to look at what are the goals of that path, what is the process of that path, what do you do, what is the nature of the path, what does it feel like, what do you experience when you're going on the path, what are your qualifications for taking up the path, and how do you become delivered. Then in part two, we're going to see how the paths fit together, what are the relationships of the path to each other. And in part three, we're going to see the qualities of those who reached at least the threshold of bhakti. Now, I see that this chapter 12 is extremely important because it really differentiates between pure bhakti and mixed bhakti, between the direct path and the indirect path, and gives us, in very few verses, in a very short and concise way, the essence of how to practice pure bhakti. When we study this chapter, we'll see that one of the impediments on the path of devotional service is when people aren't really doing devotional service. Now, Prabhupada said that if you eat a meal, you should feel satisfied. He said if you're not feeling satisfied, then either you're not really eating or there's parasites in your belly. And he said similarly, in performing Krishna consciousness, one should be achieving the result, and if not, then the possibilities are that you're not really performing Krishna consciousness or that there are some offenses. So here in this presentation, we're not looking at offenses, but we're looking at, are we really on the path? Is what we're doing actually bhakti, or is it something else? If we're doing actually bhakti, how does that work? The other thing we're going to be looking at in this understanding of chapter 12, and this will be primarily in the second part, will be what are the stages of bhakti and how do we progress from one stage to another. And it's going to be a little different analysis than we usually find in the Shraddha to Prema. We're going to be focusing on some different aspects. So in part one today, we're going to be examining, am I really in pure bhakti? Am I really doing the process? What is the process? What should I be experiencing on the path? In part two, we're going to be looking at, on the path of pure bhakti, what are my signposts? What are my landmarks? And what is it that's not pure bhakti? Especially in part two, we're going to be examining the place of varnashram in bhakti and how to relate to people doing other systems of yoga, how to preach to people who are engaged in yoga. Then part three is one of my favorite parts of any of the shastra. It's the description of how a devotee is dear to Krishna by having achieved a preliminary threshold on the path of bhakti. And it really gives us a litmus test for how we're progressing. It also gives us a key for how do I know I'm pleasing Krishna? One of the big questions devotees ask. How do I know that Krishna is pleased? So that we'll be looking at in part three. All right, part one, text 1-7, which we read. So the goal, the overall goal of either path, the overall goal of either path. Oh, I should say before we begin to really get into these verses, that this presentation is based, of course, primarily on Srila Prabhupada's translations and purports. It's also based to a large extent on the commentary of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Baladev Vidyabhushan. So you'll find that in this presentation we're quoting, and the person that I'm quoting is mentioned in parentheses on each slide. So it's either going to say Prabhupada, Vishwanath, or Baladev. So that's referring to where we're looking at. Are we looking at Srila Prabhupada's purports? Are we looking at Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary? Or are we looking at Baladev Vidyabhushan's commentary? Of course, they're all, as we would expect, in harmony. However, each of them, being a different individual, has their personal nuances, shall we say, to understanding. And we are also looking, to some extent, beyond just the Bhagavad Gita, to Srila Prabhupada's referencing these verses in his lectures or referencing these verses in other purports. Occasionally, we're also going to be going to other Prabhupada purports and lectures where Prabhupada doesn't directly reference these verses, but he's discussing the same points that are made in these verses. Okay. So the main goal of both of the paths outlined in Chapter 12 is ultimately the spiritual loving service for Shyamasundar. I was just listening to a lecture a couple days ago where Prabhupada says, all of us have as our goal a relationship with Krishna as a servant, as a friend, as a parent, or as a lover. So this is our ultimate goal of the spiritual process which we are performing. And there are two paths. Basically, Arjuna's question in text 1 is saying, what's the best way to attain devotional service to Shyamasundar? What is the best way to achieve this ultimate perfection of realizing who I am? Should I engage in bhakti from the beginning, or should I go through a step-by-step process that leads to bhakti? And I really want to emphasize that this question is not only relevant for those who are not part of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, or those who are not part of one of the Vaishnava Sanghas or part of ISKCON, but this question is very relevant even for those who believe that they are in bhakti from the beginning. That there are many times when we find devotees who mistake Gyan Mishra Bhakti or Karma Mishra Bhakti for pure bhakti. It's a very subtle thing, and Rupa Goswami talks about this as far as weeds that look just like the creeper of bhakti and may be mistaken for the creeper of bhakti, and we may be watering those weeds instead of watering the plant of bhakti. So it's quite frequently that I run into devotees, people who are followers of Srila Prabhupada, who are preaching Karma Mishra Bhakti or Gyan Mishra Bhakti without realizing it, or who are even preaching this indirect path without realizing it. So the distinction between the two is rather important. And again, we're going to get into that in a general way in this part, and a much more detailed way in the second part. So let's look at the two paths right now. We're going to look at them separate from each other. So I'm not exactly going in the order of the verses. I'm taking these seven verses as a whole and dividing them up, sort of reorganizing them into looking at the two paths separately. So let's look at bhakti from the beginning. We already know the goal. The goal is loving service to Shyamasundara. That's the direct goal. It's the ultimate goal, and it is also the immediate goal. It's not a long-term goal, and that this is going to be an important distinction, because in the other path there is another intermediate goal. So we're going to go here in direct by bhakti right to the process. So in text 2, Krishna says the process is my aveshya mano, to fix your mind on Shyamasundara. That is the process of bhakti. That is the process of bhakti. So Rupa Goswami, when giving the definition of vaidhi sadhana bhakti, the very beginning of bhakti, he says that the most essential principle is to always remember Krishna and never forget him, and that anything else is a servant of that. So the process of bhakti is absorption of the consciousness in Shyamasundara. How? Shraya Paraya. So absorption in Sima Sundar with faith, that if I just simply absorb my consciousness in Sima Sundar, then I will achieve all perfection. And this faith is not faith in the modes. In chapter 17 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes faith in the mode of goodness, faith in the mode of passion, faith in the mode of ignorance. So the type of faith that's required for engagement in bhakti is a faith, is a transcendental faith. A faith that I am a soul, I am not trying to achieve some sort of liberation, I'm not trying to achieve some sort of material sense gratification, but I'm really trying to achieve a reciprocation of love. And then there's, that was referring to internal. So far what we've looked at, to always be absorbed in Sima Sundar, and to always be absorbed in Sima Sundar with faith, is referring to our inner state of consciousness. But what about external? What do we do? Nitya Yukta Upasate. To be always worshipping Sima Sundar. So here we have a picture of yajna and arti paraphernalia. And indeed one may engage in that kind of worship. One may engage in worship of the deity form. One may engage in worship of the holy name through Harinam Sankirtan, through Harinam Japa, through Mahamantra Japa, through Gayatri Japa. One may engage in worship through studying the Shastra, as we're doing right now, through teaching the Shastra, through visiting holy places, through serving the sadhus. So one may engage, always engage in worship like that. This Nitya Yukta Upasate doesn't necessarily mean that all day long, 24 hours a day, you are engaged in an artik ceremony, but you're engaged in some direct worship of Nam Guna Rupa Lila, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So here we have on the level of the mind and heart, and the level of the body, thinking, feeling, willing. So one's thoughts absorbed in Krishna, one's feelings and emotions absorbed in Krishna, with a mood of transcendental faith, one's working senses and knowledge acquiring senses always engaged in worship. So far this description sounds like a very monastic life. If we say one is always absorbed in thoughts of Krishna and one is always engaged in worshiping Krishna, one may envision here is a person that's away from the general population. They're living in a holy place. They're studying the scriptures. They're chanting for many hours a day. They're worshiping the deity. It seems to be someone not absorbed in the world. But here, Prabhupada is talking about on a general level that this always engaged in worship doesn't only mean that one is just sitting in the temple room. Prabhupada says the devotee does not desire any achievement other than pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. His life's mission is to please Krishna. So this is also related to mood with anything. And this point again cannot be stressed enough, because it's not simply that one is always thinking of Krishna, and it's not simply that one has the goal of loving service to Krishna, and it's not simply that one has transcendental faith, and it's not simply that one is always engaged in some worship, but one's goal is simply to please Krishna. That's interesting. Just the other day, I was reading a lovely letter from Srila Prabhupada to George Harrison, where he was saying that Krishna becomes pleased when he sees that the devotee is feeling happy in service. Now, how interesting. Sometimes devotees, as I say here, we're really going to be looking at misconceptions of bhakti. So sometimes devotees feel that the gauge of their bhakti is how miserable they feel in their service. They think, well, if I enjoy my service, if I'm getting pleasure from my service, then it must be sense gratification rather than bhakti. But that's not accurate. And indeed, we'd have to really think deeply about what kind of a God we were worshipping if his pleasure was to see us miserable in his service. If you just kind of think about that for a minute, you know, if you had someone who was serving you let's say you had a you hired someone to clean your house once a week or something like that, you know, someone's doing a favor for you, and if your pleasure was to see that they were really unhappy doing it, or if your pleasure was to have them do some service that they really hated, you ask them, you know, what do you like and what do you not like, and they told you, and you said, okay, whatever you do for me, don't do anything that you enjoy. Only do things that you don't like. What kind of a person would that be? I think we'd call that an evil person. I don't think that would be a very nice person. And, of course, it wouldn't even be very self-serving, because if you engage people in things that they don't like and they're miserable at, they're not going to do a very good job. And so even if you are demoniac, you're going to want to engage people in things that they enjoy. You'd have to be a really low level of demon, you know, somebody like a Hitler or a Stalin, where you put people in labor camps and you force them to do things that they hate and you want them to be as miserable as possible. You basically see them as expendable, disposable entities that you're going to work until they kill over dead. So this is not Krishna's view. As we say, even somebody who's very materialistic and selfish will engage people according to their natures and propensities and their likes. So generally, if somebody is serving us, we want them to enjoy serving us. We don't want them to serve us at their expense. We want them to be happy serving us. Now you see this in ordinary family life, where the wife will say, you know, oh, I'd like to go to the park today. And the husband says, well, okay, if you want to go, I'll go. And she says, well, don't go just because I want to go. I want you to go because you want to go. We feel uncomfortable if people are serving us with, how would you say, resistance. So Krishna's happiness is seeing that we are happy in his service. And we will get to in part three, what is the behavior and attitude of the devotee that is most pleasing to Krishna? That's the last few verses of this chapter. If our mood is to please Krishna, if our life's mission, as Prabhupada's saying here, is to please Krishna, Krishna gives a list in this chapter. This is what's pleasing to me. This is what's pleasing to me. This is what's pleasing to me. And that's all the devotee wants. That is love. That is love. The devotee just wants that Krishna will be pleased. Now here we have one of my favorite quotes in Srila Prabhupada's books. And it really helps us understand that pure bhakti is not just a monastic process of people who are separate from society. So this is in the purport to 12.2. Prabhupada says, sometimes he chants, sometimes he hears or reads books about Krishna, or sometimes he cooks prasadam, or goes to the marketplace to purchase something for Krishna, or sometimes he washes the temple or the dishes. Whatever he does not let a single moment pass without devoting his activities to Krishna. Such action is in full samadhi. And the one here that strikes me is going to the marketplace to purchase something for Krishna. In other words, it's not, one is not simply in the temple. Whatever one is doing, one is thinking, how is Krishna pleased? How is Krishna pleased? How is Krishna pleased? Am I happy in my service? And am I the kind of person that Krishna describes later in this chapter, which makes Krishna smile? All right, so we've looked at the process. What do I do if I'm in pure bhakti? What's the goal of pure bhakti, and what do I do? Now, if we're on the path of bhakti, what will our experience be? What is the nature of the path? You know, if you think of this as a journey, so if we say, okay, you're going to go from Munich to Paris, can you go by plane, can you go by train, can you go by car? So you might say, what is the goal? The goal is Paris. What is the process? The process is I have to buy a ticket, I have to pack a suitcase, I have to go to the airport, I have to go to the check-in line. That's the process, what I do. Then what's the nature of the path? What will it feel like? So if we say, okay, if you're on a plane, what it's going to feel like, you're going to be in a little cramped seat and your ears are going to pop and so forth. If you're going to train, you're going to have a much more comfortable seat, you're going to see all the scenery and so forth. So the nature of the path is a little bit different from the process. The nature of the path is what kind of experience will you have when you're doing that process. So here Srila Prabhupada describes, and Krishna describes, that the nature of the path of direct bhakti, done from the very beginning of one's spiritual life, from day one, is very easy and natural. And Prabhupada gives this example in his purport to text 5, that we can worship the deity with our material senses. We can have the deity as the king of our home, the king of the temple, and it's very easy to understand. You know, I offer my food to the deity. I give the deity a report of my financial expenditures. I consider that everything in the home belongs to the deity. And that's a very easy and natural thing to do. One can understand that. Just like one may be living in someone else's house. So I travel a lot. I'm often living in other people's homes. And it's very easy for me to understand that the home belongs to someone else. I am staying in their home. And what I am doing has to be pleasing to them. Everything has to be in accord with their desires. What to speak of if you're a servant. So if you've ever been in society where there's servants or been where there's servants, so the servant also has a room in the house, the servant has their servant's quarters, but they are very aware that everything is for the pleasure of the owner of the house. The servants first serve the owners of the house, and then they eat afterwards in a separate room, and they're doing everything for the pleasure of the owner of the house. So this is a very simple thing to understand. It's a very easy and natural thing to understand. It's not complicated, and it's not outside of the normal range of what we can do. How does one get delivered, and what are one's qualifications? So here, Baladeva Vibhushan is saying, even though the devotees endure difficulty in withdrawing the senses from objects other than Krishna and in engaging in the various angas of bhakti, they do not experience the same suffering as the impersonalist because of the dazzling attraction of Krishna's blissful form. So, actually, I probably should have put this under nature of the path. So, there is going to be some difficulty in this process of bhakti from the beginning, because one is supposed to be always thinking of Krishna, and one's mind may go somewhere else. And there may be some difficulty doing the angas of bhakti. There may be difficulty in getting up early in the morning. There may be difficulty in chanting 16 rounds minimum every day. There may be difficulty, today's Ekadasi, for example, there may be difficulty in fasting or restricting one's diet. There may be so many difficulties. However, those difficulties are not full of suffering, because Krishna's form is so beautiful. Krishna is so attractive. And therefore, one is being delivered by one's attraction to Krishna's beautiful form. And again, even in this world, if we're very attracted to someone, even if we're very attracted to a cause, if there's something that we're working for with a lot of sacrifice and difficulty, but it's a cause that really attracts us and we really believe in, then we don't feel the sacrifice of suffering. In fact, we can be experiencing the sacrifice itself as pleasurable. And we give the example many times that it can be just as pleasurable to cook for Krishna as to eat the prasadam. Many of us have had experience of doing great sacrifice for Krishna, great sacrifice for Srila Prabhupada's mission, and we experience the sacrifice as great pleasure, because we're doing it for somebody who's so attractive. So the deliverance is that Krishna personally delivers the devotee. And this is an extremely important point. Prabhupada quotes here, the Lord himself takes him, the devotee does not need to wait to become very experienced in order to transfer himself to the spiritual sky. Such an important point of the difference between pure bhakti and other paths. The devotee, although there's a process, it's not the process that is delivering them. It is not the process that is delivering them. It is Krishna that's delivering them. Doing the process simply puts the devotee in a position where Krishna is going to deliver them. It's like Prabhupada often gives the example, the sun is shining everywhere, but you have to come out of your room. You have to open the windows to see the sun. So bhakti is simply really like that. It's really just opening the windows, walking outside. It's just putting yourself in a position where Krishna will deliver you. It's interesting, the Sri Vaishnavas have two sects, two main sects, the monkey and the cats. And the concept of, you know, the baby monkey holds on to the mother. The mother's not holding on to the baby. But the baby kitten, the mother's holding on to the kitten, and the kitten's not holding on to the mother. But you see that those those two concepts are not completely diametrically opposed. Although the monkey's holding on to the mother is very conscious of the baby monkey, and she is adjusting her behavior to accommodate the monkey that's hanging on to her. And in fact, she will go to a place where the monkey can come, the kitten and the cat, but the kitten grab on, also has to relax and cooperate with the carrying of the cat. The kitten is not struggling against the carrying of the cat. So it's still there's still something going on from both ends. So however one sees bhakti, the devotee is doing something. It's not that Krishna will go and kidnap people who are not interested in loving him, nor will a doctor go into your home and do surgery in the middle of the night without your permission. So the devotee is surrendering to Krishna. The devotee is doing something, but it's Krishna who's delivering them. And Prabhupada says, you don't need to wait to become very experienced. It's not that you have to become a perfected yogi in some mechanical sense to be delivered by Krishna on the path of bhakti. And Prabhupada says also here, even if the devotee has not attained transcendental jnana or has not properly done all aspects of dharmic karma, Krishna personally delivers the devotee. So you don't have to be perfect in jnana or karma. And this I see is, again, which we'll get to more in the second part, but this is a big mistake that devotees make, where they think that you have to be perfect in transcendental jnana or to perfectly do all your dharmic karma in order to attain pure bhakti. But that's not a fact. It's not a fact. We have Magrari the hunter, who certainly was not perfect in karma. He was a very sinful person. And he immediately took to bhakti without perfecting his life in ordinary karma first. It wasn't that he did that, nor did he become a jnani first. He immediately took to bhakti. And in the Varaha Purana, Krishna says, according to my desire unchecked, I bring them to my dham, putting them on the shoulders of Garuda without going via the path of light. So this path of light refers to, in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna describes that yogis can take the path of light or the path of darkness, that depending on the time of the year and the time of the day in which you leave your body, you can go to the Brahmajyoti or you can go to the higher planets. But Krishna says he doesn't care for that. He's not taking his devotees on that path. He's not following a mechanical process. Just according to his own desire, this is a reciprocation of love. It's a personal reciprocation of love between the devotee and the Lord. It's not some sort of a machine. The devotee is not engaged in a mechanical process, and the devotee's deliverance is not a mechanical process. And here we see this painting of Krishna on the back of Garuda, picking up the devotee from the middle of the ocean. So this is bhakti. In bhakti, the devotee is not swimming to the shore. The devotee is putting their arms up. Krishna, Krishna, I love you. Krishna, I want to be with you. Krishna, I want to reciprocate love with you. And Krishna says, yes, I want to reciprocate love with you also. If the devotee is not on their own strength swimming to the shore. And Srila Prabhupada says that no previous qualification is needed. He says pure devotional service is so powerful, however, that one may at once take to it without acquiring the previous qualification of Brahma-Bhuta life. A sincere devotee who engages in the service of the Lord automatically becomes situated in the Brahma-Bhuta stage. So here Srila Prabhupada is talking about, does one have to first attain Jnana Yoga? So one may think, well, first I have to realize transcendence and then I can think of Krishna. And I hear this a lot from devotees. You know, you can't think about Krishna until you're pure. You can't think about Krishna until you're pure. But Prabhupada's saying here, no. You can start thinking of Krishna. Remember, the process of bhakti is thinking about Krishna. You can start thinking about Krishna even when you're impure. And that thinking about Krishna, even in the stage of impurity, will bring one to the point of purity. It is thinking about Krishna that purifies one, not first I become purified and then I think of Krishna. All right, now we're going to look at the second path, going up the yoga ladder. And again, I want to emphasize that in part two, when we see how these two paths relate to each other, We're going to go into all of these points that we've touched on today in a lot more depth, and anything that's not clear today will hopefully become much clearer. So the goal of going up the yoga path is intermediate. The ultimate goal is still loving service to Sarvasundar, but the immediate goal of the yoga ladder is a little different. And Krishna says in text 4 that those who go through this indirect path at last achieve me. So what do we mean by me? So Baladev Vijayabhushan says that this me is a form predominated by extreme majesty, which could be, say, Narayana. And Vaikuntha, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says this me is the impersonal Brahman. Srila Prabhupada says this me is Sri Krishna or Vasudev. So Srila Prabhupada is saying that even on the indirect path, one will eventually come, at last, as Krishna says, at last, one will eventually come to Vasudev Krishna. And what about the immediate goal of the indirect path? The immediate goal of the indirect path is not Vasudev Krishna. And this is the main question in text 1. Now, we should understand text 1 very clearly. Arjuna is not asking, why would Arjuna ask? There would be no reason for Arjuna to ask about ultimate goal. Arjuna is not saying what's better as an ultimate goal, personalism or impersonalism. He's saying what's better as a path. Is it better to start bhakti immediately, or is it better to first become purified in another way and then go to bhakti? Now, what exactly is Arjuna asking in text 1? There's a little difference of opinion among the acharyas. When Arjuna in text 1, he's saying, evam satata yukta te yukta ye bhaktas tvam prayuparsate ye chap aksharam avyaktam te sham ke yoga vittama. So this aksharam avyaktam is what's in question here. Aksharam is beyond the senses. Srila Prabhupada talks about this aksharam in reference to the prayers of Queen Kunti, which we're going to be studying also in our general morning class. It means, Prabhupada gives the word for word here in the Bhagavad Gita as beyond the senses. Prabhupada also explains that aksharam means beyond the alphabet. Like in English, we have, you know, A to Z, A to Z. So something that can't be described by the alphabet. Aksharam, that refers to the Sanskrit letters. And avyaktam, unmanifested. You can't perceive it. So what does this mean? Does this mean the self? Does this mean those who meditate on their own self? Or does this mean those who meditate on Brahman? So Baladev Vijayabhushan and Ramanujacharya both say that Arjuna is referring to someone who meditates on the self. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and Srila Prabhupada says that Arjuna is asking about those who meditate on Brahman. Although Srila Prabhupada also indicates in his purport to text 3 and 4 that Arjuna is asking about both the super soul and the individual soul. And we could say that whether your goal is the soul or whether your goal is Brahman, that certainly you're going to realize all aspects of this unmanifested, the self, Brahman, and the super soul. Okay, let's look at this description, and we just talked about this, we'll mention it again, aksharam and avyaktam. Again, aksharam literally means beyond the alphabet, beyond what can be described or understood by words, beyond the ability to perceive something that's not manifested. So, of course, this is quite different than what we were talking about with the deity. So this is the goal, to achieve something that is beyond the senses. And let's look at some more descriptions here from text 3 to 4, where Krishna's describing the goal, right? In the previous slide we looked at, it was Arjuna describing the goal as simply aksharam and avyaktam. And here, Krishna describing the goal of the indirect process. He again uses this aksharam, which Prabhupada translates here as that which is beyond the perception of the senses. Again, referring you to Bhagavatam 1.8, where Prabhupada describes the same word as beyond the alphabet. Anirdesham, indefinite. Avyaktam, again, Krishna also uses, unmanifest. Sarvatragam, all-pervading, is everywhere. a chinchim. Chinchim means to know. So chinchim, inconceivable, you can't know it with the mind. Kutastam, unchanging. It's always the same. Achalam, immovable. Dhruvam, fixed. So this is the description of this intermediate goal of the indirect path. Beyond the senses, indefinite, unmanifested, everywhere, inconceivable, unchanging, immovable, and fixed. Now, you might ask, why would somebody want to? Why would somebody want to go through the indirect process? Now, again, in asking this question, please remember that this doesn't just apply to people who do not consider themselves on the path of bhakti, but this also applies to people who consider themselves on the path of bhakti. So the answer is they think it's better to remove all obstacles first and then perform bhakti, rather than remove all obstacles to bhakti by bhakti itself. So they're figuring, before I can engage in pure bhakti, let me do something else to prepare myself for bhakti, then bhakti will be easier. And the path of bhakti is, I'm going to engage in bhakti immediately, and that will make bhakti, that's enough. I don't have to do something preliminary. We see this mentality of let me do something else first is present in people who say, well, I can't really engage in full bhakti right now because I have, you know, a husband and or a wife and kids and a job and I live far from the temple, and, you know, first I've got to take care of that, and then I can engage in bhakti later. So first I'm going to take care, first I'm going to become purified by doing my duty, etc., etc. Or when people say, you know, I can't think of Krishna when I chant Hare Krishna until I'm pure. You know, that's a very common one. Now, we should note that many people on the indirect path do not even have bhakti as their goal in the beginning. So there are many people on the indirect path, and this would, of course, not refer to people who are followers of Srila Prabhupada, but there are many people on the indirect path who have as their ultimate goal this knowing the unmanifested, the all-pervading, and so forth. And they may take up bhakti as their goal after having achieved that, or they may not. So there's really two practitioners, or perhaps more, but let's just say there's two general categories of practitioners of the indirect path. One who has bhakti as their ultimate goal, but thinks it's better to go in this way, and one who doesn't even have bhakti as their ultimate goal. Now, Baladev Vidyabhushan has this nice quote about why would you first want to realize the self. He says, Swanubhava purvakshas purvakasya hari Danasya Banda Mulatva Tena Nirvigna Tat Praptir Ityake. This means, some say Ityake, because meditation on Hari, Hari Danasya, is firmly grounded Banda Mulatva when preceded by experience of one's own self, Swanubhava Purvasya, attainment of Hari Tat Prapti by means of that meditation, Tena, is without obstacles, Nirvigna. So what these people are saying is, let me first realize the self. Let me first become free from bodily identification. Let me first give up all of my upadis and designations. And then I'll be pure. And then I can realize Hari without difficulty. So you can see how we can get that kind of mentality. And in fact, Srila Prabhupada will sometimes say things that can be understood in this way. Here's a quote. Prabhupada says, self-realization, the Brahma-Bhuta stage, which is mentioned, of course, in Bhagavad Gita 18.54 and Bhagavatam 4.30.20, is symptomized by joyfulness. One never laments for any loss, nor is one very enthusiastic when there is some gain. One sees everyone on an equal level through spiritual understanding. These qualities are preliminary to entering into pure devotional service. So one can easily read that and think, oh, okay, I've got to do Brahma-Bhuta first in some way other than pure bhakti, and then I can do pure bhakti. Now, although Prabhupada's saying that the Brahma-Bhuta stage will happen first, He's not saying that one should do it by something other than bhakti. That's the misconception. So the indirect path says you have to attain the self first by a process other than bhakti. Then you can do pure bhakti. Prabhupada's saying, yes, you're going to realize the self first, but you're going to realize the self through the process of bhakti. Now, what is this indirect process? What do you do? So we just had sort of an extensive discussion of the goal, which we didn't do for the process of pure bhakti, mainly because that's not in this chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Now we're going to be comparing what is the process. What do you do in the indirect path? Well, interesting, look at this. Paryupasate, you're also engaged in worship. You cannot attain perfection even on this other path without worship. Then you have to saniyam yendriya grahman. Indriya, the senses, control all of the senses. Then sarvatra sama buddhaya. You have to see everyone equally. You can't see the difference between yourself and others. You can't see, oh, this is for my benefit, this is for others' benefit. I'm better than others. I'm different from others. Sarva bhuta hite rataha, working for the welfare of all living entities. I don't think we can emphasize enough that whatever path of self-realization one takes up, one has to be treating all living entities equally. And one has to be working for the welfare of all living entities. If someone is seeing distinctions between living entities based on the body, I mean, of course, there's some practical distinctions that you don't, you know, invite your dog to dinner, we hope, and you invite a human guest to dinner. So there's some practical distinctions, obviously. But on the spiritual platform, you don't see distinctions. And if one sees these distinctions, one isn't even on the indirect path. So if one claims to be on either the direct or indirect path, one has to be seeing all living entities equally. Now, what's the nature of this path? Krishna says, okay, this is an often quoted verse, Klesho jikatarashtesham avyakta sakyachetasam avyakta hibatir jukam tena vadya avyakta. It's very difficult and troublesome. And it's very theoretical. You know, it's just, okay, you're not the body, you're not the body, you're not the body. All living entities are equal. You have to control your senses. You know, you're really having to control your senses and your mind by force of will. So it's a very artificial, difficult, and troublesome process. And anyone who's been applying this sort of method and this sort of mentality to the aspects of bhakti will find that it's very difficult and troublesome. I mean, if one is feeling that one's practice of bhakti is very difficult and troublesome and very theoretical, then he might be on the indirect path, thinking that it's bhakti. Because bhakti's not like that. And you don't realize the blissful portion. You may be gaining knowledge and a sense of eternality, but not bliss. So that's the nature of the indirect path. It's very difficult. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that it's like trying to stop a river, trying to stop your senses. So again, if that's someone's experience in bhakti, that they feel they're trying to control their senses, like trying to control a river, or as Arjuna says in the sixth chapter, trying to control your mind like it's the raging wind, maybe you're not really doing bhakti. Because this is the experience of those on the indirect path. Now, as we said before, it's interesting that even the indirect path needs worship. That Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, furthermore, even that goal of impersonal Brahman, which is attained by such suffering, is attained only by having a mixture with bhakti. Without bhakti to the Lord, the worshippers of the impersonal Brahman attain only suffering and not Brahman. He says, Brahma says, as a person who beats an empty husk of wheat cannot get grain, one who simply speculates cannot achieve self-realization, his only gain is trouble. So here it's explained that even on the indirect path, there must be some bhakti. Otherwise, there will be only suffering. So you can see how easy it is for somebody on the path of bhakti to end, you know, who thinks they're on the path of bhakti, to actually be on this mixed platform, because worship is part of both of these paths, the indirect and the direct path. And because there's some worship, therefore there's some experience of spirituality. But the primary experience on the indirect path, until one achieves their intermediate goal is going to be struggle and suffering, whereas the primary experience on the direct path is Kevala Nanda Kanta. Prabhupada says the unmanifested realization is against the nature of the spiritual blissful self. Right, the spiritual blissful self as spiritual senses and manifest and relationship. Right, so when you're on the indirect path, you feel like you're doing something unnatural. You feel like you're doing something against your own nature. Also, the indirect path is very dangerous. In 4.2.28, at the curse of doctor's sacrifice, one who takes a vow to satisfy Lord Shiva or who follows such principles will certainly become an atheist and be diverted from transcendental scriptural injunctions. So this indirect path where one is engaged in uniting the Shakti with Shiva, or one is engaged in trying to become impersonal, or it can be very dangerous. Now, another thing about the indirect path is you can't even do it properly unless you have prior qualifications. We were saying in bhakti, anybody can take to it immediately. Prabhupada's saying you don't have to become perfect in Gyan Yoga or Karma Yoga. You don't have to follow all the rules of Dharma to take to bhakti. But in Prabhupada's book, Renunciation Through Wisdom, and we're going to discuss this a lot more in part two when we go through the latter, Prabhupada says those who have been able to eradicate according to the dictates of their social and spiritual order and who have thus acquired sufficient piety are qualified to practice Karma Yoga. Gradually they progress to Gyan Yoga, and finally in meditation they realize the transcendental and supreme position of the Lord. So in order to direct path, as Prabhupada says, the dictates of their social and spiritual order. You cannot go directly from being a sinful person to the indirect path. Now, what is the deliverance? How do people on the indirect deliver? This is also fascinating. It takes perfection to the effort through a mechanical process with a mixture of worship. But how do they get to the final goal? That's the intermediate goal. How do such persons get to the final goal of loving service to Shyama Sundar? It has to be by the grace of a devotee. That's the only way that somebody can move from the indirect path to the ultimate goal of bhakti. Prabhupada says, by the grace of some devotee, such a transcendentalist, highly learned in the process of Gyan Yoga, they come to the point of bhakti yoga or devotional service. At that time, long practice in impersonalism also becomes a source of trouble because he cannot give up the idea. Therefore, an embodied soul is always in difficulty with the unmanifest, both at the time of practice and at the time of realization. And so this is a very interesting point, and I always give the example in reference to the statement of Srila Prabhupada of my nephew. So my nephew studied in his own religion, not in Vaishnavism, in essentially a brahmachari ashram with a spiritual master. And they were very strict about the men having any dealings with women. So that at a certain point, you know, he got to be in his 20s, and he went to his teacher, his guru, and he said, I think now I want to marry. So his teacher said, well, up until now, you've told you not to look at any woman, but when I introduce you to a woman, I certainly want you to look at her. So this is the problem with the indirect path. One is focused on the unmanifested, the all-pervading, the changeless, the inconceivable, etc., etc. It's very hard to attain perfection because you're working against your nature. You know, you have to, as Prabhupada says, you have to understand the non-perceptual feelings. I mean, how do you do that? And if you achieve it through all this difficulty, then to switch and think about Krishna the person is also very difficult. So after going through all this trouble on the indirect path in such a mechanical way, by force, the only way that you can attain to ultimate perfection is by the grace of a devotee. Okay, so there we end part one. All right, so Ramananda, if you want to give the screen back to yourself.
Okay. I don't really need to change the screen back, but I can. Anyway, just 1 second. Okay, I have unmuted. So I have a couple of questions, but I'm going to wait.
Okay, just 1 second. Let me set this up for the recording. Okay, if anybody has any questions.
Mother Emma, I'm going to ask you a question. You mentioned that on the indirect that there was no bliss. And my understanding was that one reaches Brahman, that it is very pleasurable and it is a type of bliss, hence it's often described as Brahmananda. However, the jiva won't stay there. He'll fall from there ultimately because he doesn't come, it's not his constitutional position, albeit pleasurable and blissful, but there's no devotion. One falls down because he hasn't taken shelter Krishna's lotus feet through devotion. Therefore, he becomes lonely, falls back, comes back down again because of that desire for reciprocation. But in fact, there is bliss at that level, just not our constitution.
Mother Ermila, I'll have to let you know that there is a lot of echo coming from your side. If it's possible to mute and unmute yourself.
Okay, so this is a very good question. I just like, we're here in Hawaii, so one of the main pastimes of the Hawaiian residents, what to speak of the tourists, is to go to the beach. So you leave aside your normal life and you go to the beach. There's expansive sand and then just the waves. Not much variety. And people sit on the beach and just look at the waves. They can't see very far, as one poet said, and they can't see very, very deep. And there's a kind of bliss in that. And there's a kind of bliss to just going in the water, forgetting your life, forgetting your work, your family, your health, your money, and just floating in the waves. So you could say that that's a kind of bliss. It's peace. It's relief. It's complete relief. It's not partial relief. You know, material happiness is partial relief. I'm hungry and I eat. You know, like that. But Brahman is total relief, but it's not a positive bliss. Total relief for a conditioned soul is definitely happiness, but it's not a positive happiness. Therefore, one is not really experiencing the Ananda feature. Of course, Krishna says in the 14th chapter, Brahmano hi prajistaham amritasya vyastracha sasvatasya jitarmasya sukasya ikantikasya, that the Brahman is the constitutional position of ultimate happiness. So one cannot experience the real Ananda of the Supreme without being also realizing Brahman. Therefore, it's the beginning, it's the platform from which Ananda springs. But in and of itself, it's really more of a neutral position.
Yes, Mataji, I'd like to ask you a question, if I may. You mentioned earlier, I'm doing two things at once here. You mentioned earlier that one cannot be blissful on the indirect path. But we also hear that, and Prabhupada said, that too much austerity in the path of bhakti will harden the heart, which means it's going to be impossible to be blissful in that situation as well. So given that scenario, does that mean that too much austerity on the path of bhakti is like an indirect path?
Yes. In Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Srila Rupa Goswami explains items that are not part of the path of bhakti. One of them is varnashram. It says varnashram is not part of the angas of bhakti. Another is gyan, and another is vairagya. So basically talking about gyan yoga and karma yoga and karmakanda, and that none of them are on the path of bhakti. Now, Prabhupada does say that gyan and vairagya can be useful in the beginning. But mostly these things should be natural results of bhakti rather than part of bhakti. Now, having said all that, Srila Prabhupada also says very clearly that any spiritual progress that says you don't require any austerity is cheating. And of course Rupa Goswami does give not only what to do in bhakti, but what not to do. So there are, as Prabhupada calls them, rules and regulations, positive and negative injunctions. For sure. I mean, if you want a loving relationship with another human, we're gone. Is that all right? Okay. If you want a relationship with another human jiva, there's also going to be positives and negatives. Yes? Am I online?
Yes, you're online. I understand your question. And I
wasn't
agree
sure.
With your
point. You know, so the question is, when we're talking about too much austerity, let's look at this in two ways. So Prabhupada talks about a nectar devotion, about over-endeavoring. And he defines over-endeavoring as taking up austerities or practices that you can't maintain. So if somebody says, okay, I'm going to chant, 120 rounds a day, I'm going to live on milk, I'm only going to sleep for an hour a day, they can't maintain it. And that can be a cause of fall down. So that's one sense in which we shouldn't take on too much austerity. We should take on an austerity that we can maintain. And that's going to be somewhat different for each individual, and it's going to be different at different times in our life, and this is one of the reasons why one should have a spiritual master. The other thing in reference to austerity is we are not being purified by our austerities. We are being purified by thinking of Krishna and our loving relationship with Krishna, and we are taking on austerities as part of pleasing Krishna. Exactly like parents go through a lot of trouble to please their children. A man goes through a lot of trouble to please his wife. A wife goes through a lot of trouble to please her husband. But the point is pleasing the other person. That's the point. And if you're doing some sacrifice and austerity in order to please another person, and if it's a person that you have affection for, you do not experience that austerity as suffering. You experience that austerity as pleasure. Sarvagatam Brahma, Nitya Yajna Pratishtitam. The all-pervading Brahman is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. So if one is doing sacrifice out of love, that sacrifice itself becomes joyful. So the points here are that take on austerity that's proper in bhakti and that one can maintain. Do the austerity as a way of pleasing Krishna and a way of enhancing love. Then that is on the direct path of bhakti. If one is doing very hard austerities, which one cannot maintain, if one is doing that by force of just determination and power and willpower, if one is doing austerities thinking, I am by my own power going to control my senses and achieve perfection, that is on the indirect path.
If I might ask one more question in that regard, Mr.
Chairman. I'm sorry, what?
If I might be able to ask one more question in that regard.
Okay, sure.
Because you said that we have to perform, we should perform austerities that we know we can maintain. And so my question is, that would tend to lend itself to being comfortable, wouldn't it?
Is there some requirement that you have to be uncomfortable?
Well,
I don't know that we have to be uncomfortable.
Is it ever said that in order to, that your test of whether or not you're performing bhakti is whether or not you're uncomfortable?
Well, not exactly, but when I say comfort, I mean like an easygoing life because you're practicing something that you're able to maintain. You understand what I'm saying?
One has to have a guru. You know, the Rupa Goswami is saying the first thing in bhakti is you have to have a guru. We're not meant to be our own gurus. You know, as a teacher, if I'm teaching a child, then I've always drawn the picture of three concentric circles, the comfort zone, the learning zone, and the panic zone. So you want to push people out of their comfort zone into the learning zone, but you don't want to push them into the panic zone. And Prabhupada says the manager should be expert in always presenting fresh challenges to the devotees that they're going to rise and meet. So therefore, we have to have, we can't just be our own guide. Because if we're just our own guide, we'll either just try to have an easygoing life, or we may push ourselves into our panic zone and fall on our nose. So to know how to progress, it's a very individual thing. You know, what's my comfort zone may be your panic zone, and vice versa. And it's maybe different things in different areas. There may be certain aspects of bhakti that come more easily to some people than others. But still, one has to do austerities that one can maintain. And that's definitely Prabhupada's instructions. That doesn't mean you're in your comfort zone. But nor should you be put yourself into a panic zone. So I think I could take just one more question.
Thank you very much, my dear.
Oh, just one more question. Ouch. Can I get one in?
Yeah, okay, sorry.
That's okay. The first verse, it says, what is more perfect, engaging in devotional service or the worship of the impersonal Brahman. Now, I know you alluded to that, but I still am confused. Because when I read this again and again, it appears to me that what Arjuna is asking, what's better, impersonal worship or devotional service? But what you're saying is that actually he's referring to the step-by-step process, bhakti mixed, etc. So it appears it's very narrowly focused the way.
Yes, it's exactly correct. What Arjuna is asking here is, do I start bhakti from the beginning, or do I first go through a process? Do I first realize the self or Brahman, depending on how you want to interpret it? Prabhupada interprets it as both, and then go to bhakti. So that is Arjuna's question. He's not asking about, is impersonalism better as an ultimate goal? He has no reason to ask such a question. So it's already been established that bhakti for Krishna is the ultimate goal. So Arjuna is not asking here, is impersonalism better as an ultimate goal? But he's asking, is the indirect path, which is what Krishna will explain in this chapter. And you can see this, first of all, by what went before in Bhagavad Gita, and also by how Krishna responds to his question. So Krishna responds to his question by describing both the direct and the indirect step-by-step path. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Śrīla Prabhupāda.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All glories to Śrīla Prabhupāda. Thank you.
Hi,
thank you.